WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
With me is jazz critic and Village Voice columnist Stanley Crouch. He writes regularly on jazz and theater as well as black issues and politics. Crouch is also a drummer and has recruited as a sideman on several albums, including a couple with saxophonist David Murray. He's in Philadelphia to participate in a symposium tonight on the bop era. It's a jazz forum and concert that will feature Stanley Crouch, Charles Bowen, and Reggie Workman, and this will be at the Painted Broad Arts Center at 8:30 this evening. Stanley Crouch, welcome to Fresh Air. It's nice to meet you. How'd you start listening to jazz?
At home, when I was a little boy.
Radio, records, was it in the house?
Well, it was records, and then there were guys. My mother was from Texas, and her second husband was a guy from Oklahoma, and there was a piano player who was a cousin of the guy of my mother's second husband. And so he played like a lot of barrel house piano and stuff like that. And so there were always... So, you know, I always heard that kind of sound. And she had an extensive collection of Duke Ellington, Fats Waller records and stuff like that. And then things like Ivory Joe Hunter's Since I Met You, Baby. Well, Since I Met You, Baby. And so it was always around the house, you know. So I heard a lot of those things. And at a certain point, I really began to be attracted to the sound of Tricky Sam Nanton's trombone in Duke Ellington's band, you know. This was like the early 50s because I was born in December 1945. And so from that point on, I, you know, started liking the music. And at a certain point, too, jazz offered me a way to separate myself from the rest of the student body. You know, so the Rockin' Robin, Smokey Robinson, the Miracles people. Although I did like those things and would like to go to the house parties with the red light bulbs and rub up against the girls, you know, and all of that like everybody else, I still preferred to, you know, pretend that I was some kind of part of some kind of an elite by virtue of listening to Miles Davis or Thelonious Monk or whomever.
What did that mean more specifically to be listening to jazz? What were the connotations of that?
When I was growing up, there were a lot of street gangs, and in a certain sense, the party music of rhythm and blues you would often hear blasting out of the cars of these guys who had these processes and these conks and these head rags on and teeth broken out and, you know, these homemade tattoos and so on, you know. And jazz always was something that was beyond them on one level, you know. Although some thoroughbred scum, if you will, who lived behind us and dealt, you know, barbiturates and so on and sat up all weekend dropping bennies and dropping uppers and, I go to in the argument of today, dropping uppers and downers, they were the first people that I heard playing Thelonious Monk. So I was going back to the garage one day and I heard this piano player in there saying, E-ba-doo-dee, dee-ba-boo-bee, dee-boo-be-boo-ee-da-doo-dee-boo-ba. And so I went up there. I wanted to find out what that was. The guy said, come in here. I said, that's Monk. I said, this is advanced stuff here, boy. This ain't like everybody else. This is Monk. So it was Monk at the five spot, you know. And so that was my introduction to Thelonious Monk. So there, see, and I think that, along with a variety of other experiences that I've had, remind me of a thing that Duke Ellington told me once when I was interviewing him about 12, 13 years ago. He said that he discovered at a certain point in his life that you never knew what station information of great importance was going to come from, you know. Because he said when he first came to Harlem, there might be a waiter who knew, who was a history buff about the Caribbean. You know, he might be serving tables, but the subject of the Caribbean came up, and he knew who ruled when and how this thing changed and that, and somebody else knew something about aerodynamics, et cetera. And so that was one of the signal experiences of my youth in it. I began to learn that you could, even though these guys superficially, right, would have been what I considered part of the lower depths that they were playing Thelonious Monk records and dropping pills, you know what I mean, and playing Wiss and Coon Can all weekend and so on, and trying to get girls over there and dropping pills in them and turning the heater up real high so the girls would pass out so they could take advantage of them, as the saying goes.
Did you ever go through a thing where you felt that you had to start doing that too if you were to become an official jazz listener or jazz participant or jazz player, which you became too?
Well, I did well, you know, at a certain point, I did most of what there was to do. You know what I mean? I did the regular vandalism, you know, you know, buying liquor and behind a liquor store and get drunk, come home and throw up all over your bed. I did the whole thing. It wasn't that unique. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it was part of a pattern. But yeah, I mean, but at a certain point, you know, in this country, in adolescence, you try to figure out what separates you from your parents, or what makes you capable of hanging out with the older guys. And I never liked being a kid. I never liked being a kid. I always thought the grown-ups were doing something that was much more interesting. You know, I'm working on a piece like about that now for Vogue magazine about women, and the idea that I was never really attracted to women that were young. Not that I'm 37. I'm where I was in terms of what my attraction was when I was 20, 17. Because the young girls, it's never, no. And so it's those other ones over there, they look like they know more what I need to know. You know, I don't just mean sexually, but just in general, you know. And so adolescence and those things were really kind of a drag to me because I always wanted to get older as quick as possible, you know. And now that I'm getting older, I just want to get even older.
Really?
Yeah, because I went to see Buster Smith. I'm working on this book about this. I'm working on Charlie Parker's biography. And I went to interview his first seminal influence, Buster Smith, who's a Kansas City. He's from Texas, but a Kansas City alto saxophonist. And he's 78. And he's got a roofing business. When I last saw him Tuesday morning about 10 o'clock, he was getting ready to go up on this guy's roof and fix the guy's roof, you know. And so I don't know. I don't envy anybody that's 15, 20, 25. I mean, I'd hate to be that age.
So you started listening to jazz when you were young. As you've gotten older, how have your tastes in jazz changed and the periods and the musicians that you're interested in changed?
Well, the kind of things I liked when I was a kid, I like even more now. And I think that some of the things that I used to really be thrilled by because they were outside the convention, I'm less excited by now because I'm not always as at this point, I don't always find that music has as much substance to it in terms of the breadth of elements that it brings in. And also, I think that as you become, or as I became more aware of what I consider the real elements of the jazz tradition and its unique distinction, or what makes it distinctly different from, say, European music and so-called third world music, I became less and less enamored of those would-be avant-garde musics that were second or third rate imitations of classical, you know, contemporary music. You know what I mean? Like, if I want to hear Stockhausen or Boulez or Bartok or those guys, I just go listen to them.
Who were some of the people you'd put in that category of being the second rate imitations?
Well, I mean, I have resolved of late to cease, you know, chopping these guys up, because I always chop the same ones up, so it's no point in going back over them again. You know, but and also I'm not interested in that, you know, third rate imitations of ethnic music. If I want to hear an African percussion ensemble, I got records that I can listen to them, those guys really playing that. I don't need to listen to somebody from Chicago or somewhere beating on some drums. You know what I mean? On that level. Now, I did recently hear a guy who was seriously who did that very, very well, though, who has a group in Brooklyn. And he went to Senegal and actually studied as somebody who would want to be an opera singer or something like that, might go to Europe or go to Italy or whatever, or somebody who was interested in kabuki would travel to Japan and really study it from the masters. And so he really is different, you know. But by and large, I like Monk better, you know.
If you're just joining us, Stanley Crouch is my guest, and this is a subject I'd like to get back to in a couple of minutes, but we asked you to bring some recordings with you that were among your favorites, and I'd like to play one of the ones that you brought with you before we continue talking.
Right.
The first one we're going to hear is by Jay McShann. Do you want to tell us a little bit about why you're...
Well, I think McShann, you know, he's the guy who... Charlie Parker worked in his band from 1939 to 1942. He's from Muskogee, Oklahoma. And he's a real master of that 1930s style piano playing. And I don't see it as nostalgic. I see it as just a classic thing. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like if you see a great movie that was made in 1939, 1940, it's not nostalgic to like it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And plus, he plays better now than he played then because he's older. He knows the piano better. I would just suggest for listeners, his beat. I mean, the things that some of you may hear him doing, you may think you hear this in movies, you know, period pieces and so on, but you don't really. I mean, this is a guy who really can play this, and I just think this Lulu's Back in Town is a very, very remarkable performance. I mean, it's tempo control and just the independence of the right hand and the left hand, plus the exuberance of it. I mean, it's got that real joyful, happy sound, you know.
Yeah, before we hear it, I want to mention to our listeners that Jay McShann will be in Philadelphia if you'd like to hear him perform next Tuesday night at the Afro-American Museum, and we hope that he'll be with us on Fresh Air in the afternoon at about 3:30. So let's listen to this recording of Jay McShann's version of Lulu's Back in Town.
Thank you.
Jim McShannon is recording of Lulu's Back in Town, an album that my guest Stanley Crouch has brought with him this afternoon. Stanley Crouch is a Village Voice columnist and jazz critic. You referred to, well, I think you did anyways, and if you didn't, I'll bring it up. Anyways, but jazz has gone through periods of being very politically identified or very spiritually identified. What do you think of some of the messages that have been associated with jazz music through either the lyrics or through the discussions of the people who play it? And I'm thinking of, like, the radical politics of the avant-garde of the past couple of decades, or this, the spirituality of it. Do you find those to be potent messages for you? And do you find differences? You were talking before about second and third rate or imitation avant-gardists and imitation European composers. Did you think that holds true in politics and spirituality and jazz also, that there's the people who are imitating messages?
Well, I don't know. You know, some people have been able to summon a religious depth in their artistry and their work. And many others just seem to be posing to me. I mean, since I was around and knew most of these clowns, I mean, it was just garbage. I mean, it was a trick. You know, it seemed basically what it usually meant was an excuse to not have to learn how to play. You know what I mean? So if you could say, I'm spiritual, then you didn't have to be able to play in tune. You didn't have to know how to finger the instrument. You didn't have to know anything except that you were religious. You know, my attitude was that, go to a monastery. You know what I mean? Just go pray somewhere. But, I mean, don't ask people to come pay here. You fumble through a set and explain that away and explain your ineptitudes away with some kind of religiosity or something like that. You know what I'm saying? Politics. Most jazz musicians don't know anything about politics. They don't know much more about politics than they know about business. Most of them don't know anything about business. Now, that doesn't make them good or bad musicians. But the average musician doesn't know enough about history, economic factors, a variety of things that make a political situation. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, if some musicians start talking to me about politics, it's a joke. By and large, that because most musicians don't read that much, and you don't learn that much about politics, getting on band buses and getting on trains and picking up groupies and pushing groupies away, or putting on jazz interviewers, that's how you gonna learn something about politics from that. The average jazz guy, when he says politics, the most he knows about it is that in a variety of circles and situations, it is in the interest of a black band leader to have a white guy in the band, because that makes the white people feel comfortable in the audience, because one of them is up there, and it makes the club owners like him better. Now, I've had many musicians tell me, I said, why you got this clown in your band, man? He can't really play. He said, they like him. I said, well, who are they? He said, you know who they are. They like him. Right? Now, I'm not, by no means am I saying that every time you see a mixed band, that's the reason why the guy is there. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I'm saying that's a term in jazz when somebody says so-and-so's playing politics. They mean that he's hiring people because he will achieve a certain kind of ethnic identification at large that he wouldn't get otherwise.
Who are some of the musicians that you think have succeeded in getting some kind of spiritual or political message across through their music or whatever? And who are the people you think are real failures?
I think John Coltrane was sincere, you know, but I think Pharoah Sanders is probably a sincere guy in that, you know. And Albert Isla may have been. A lot of the other guys, it's just a con job. Or it's just pretentious. You know what I'm saying? I mean, like, see when you study the history of black people in the United States. See, black people, see, there's one thing that's very, very observable. I mean, Philip Roth has seen it with, Philip Roth and Saul Bellow have seen it with Jews. Albert Murray and Ralph Ellison have seen it with black people. There's two minority groups that have an enormous penchant for being sucked into fads. You know what I mean? If there is a new psychoanalytic fad that arises at what time is it? 4:25 at 4:30. Somebody Jewish in Philadelphia will know about it by 4:45. You know what I'm saying? If there's another absurd hairdo that is reminiscent of the dreadlocks, which look like dirty pipe cleaners growing out of somebody's head, that appears in Philadelphia at 4:25, by a quarter of five, somebody black in Philadelphia will know about it and will probably be busy putting that on his or her head. Now, I just said that to say that musicians are not free of this problem either. You know what I mean? So you can, I mean, like, because see, styles in music, styles in jazz change on the basis of, I mean, for instance, if a guy is on tour, right, and he plays a certain way and more women come up to him than they come up to anybody else, by the time that tour is over, a lot of other guys are going to be using those things that he uses. If those are the things that blow the girls' dresses up, they'll say, well, that guy, he played that low B flat, boy, them girls, they like that. I'm going to drop me some B flats in there tomorrow night. So what I'm saying is the dynamic of what makes something happen is not necessarily what ends up being said to somebody in Downbeat or somebody in Europe. And see, you can tell Europeans anything because they don't know anyway.
When you write things like this, are you ever accused of either being too conservative or being a wet blanket or breaking ranks with black people by being critical? Or breaking ranks with musicians because you're also a musician?
I'm a sexist swine, an Uncle Tom, a reactionary, a right winger. Let me see, what else? I haven't been accused of being a child molester yet, but I'm sure somewhere up the line somebody will figure out a way to push that into the grab bag of pejorative instead of I find myself assaulted with. But, you know, I didn't come to New York to be liked by those people. You know what I'm saying? And from childhood, I never was very good at running along with the pack, you know. And I think that basically that there are far more interesting and vital things that people have to offer than the latest trend in sociopolitical thought. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like one of the reasons I get upset with the yowlings in the Village Voice about the oppression of women is that it negates the enormous strides that women have made purely on the basis of excellence. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like you would think that people like Sue Simmons don't exist. You know what I mean? You would think that O'Connor doesn't exist. You know what I mean? She's not on the Supreme Court because somebody said we got to have somebody with a dress on under one of those robes. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's the same thing that I see when people act as though there is no Richard Pryor, there's no Ralph Ellison, there's no Reggie Jackson, there was no Maynard Jackson, there was no Coleman Young. I mean, enormous. See, I think that's the worst thing you can do to a group is have people making these enormous strides. You know what I mean? I mean, look, for instance, in the women's situation, when you get to the point that a declared lesbian like Navratilova is on the cover of Newsweek magazine, lesbianism and all, and is still seen as a great tennis player, when just a few years ago, Billie Jean King's career came crashing down on the basis of that, you're not going to tell me we're in the same position we were, or women are in the same position that they were a few years ago. You know what I'm saying? And all I'm saying is that, see, what I mean is that in the United States, everything that any group gets, they have to take it. They have to take it. I mean, if you want to be on the Supreme Court, if you want to be the mayor of a city, if you want to own a radio station, if you want to become the head of the police department, if you want to run the FBI, whatever it is you want to do, you know, you're going to have to get in the ring and take it. This is not going to get handed to you, you know? And everything that any minority group, quote unquote, has in the United States, they took it. Nobody did them any favors. They were given nothing, you know? And in this kind of a society, you cannot afford to give out favors. You know what I mean? I mean, not that there isn't an enormous amount of corruption and log rolling and nepotism and all of that, but I mean that the advances that Hispanics, Jews, the Irish at a certain time, any other group have made have been primarily based on the fact that they were able to fulfill a job or a series of jobs.
Well, you know, in one of your recent columns, you wrote that black politics has focused too much on helplessness and oppression instead of mobilization. Is this kind of what you're referring to?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, see, look, what I'm saying is the worst thing you can do is tell some young, first thing, it is very dangerous to any group of people to continually tell them that their experience is totally separated from the sweep of human experience, okay? You create bitterness, you can create a certain kind of a bitterness and a feeling of hopelessness that is more injurious to the group than it is anything else, you know? And I think that that has been one of the failures of black politics in the North, you see? Because, see, black people in the South changed the South, and they know it, and the white people know it. You know what I'm saying? You know, so it's, you can't tell them they didn't do anything, because they know they did something.
Well, how have your attitudes, say, from the 60s until now, changed about effective ways of mobilizing or effective ways of getting more power?
Well, you know, I went through various yo-yo periods of politics. You know, I mean, I got swept along with the ethnic nationalism and a bunch of other things. But see, in a lot of ways, see, ethnic nationalism for minorities served the same purpose as being a hippie served for white people, which was it was a way of expressing an adolescent dissatisfaction with the nature of the way the world worked. It wasn't really necessarily that serious. That is to say that most black Americans who would have run around in robes and so on talking about they wanted to get back to their real African culture, right? I used to say to super duper rah rah black females who were ethnic nationalists, I said, "Well, are you gonna embrace clitoridectomies too?" I said, "Well, how much tradition do you want, dear? I mean, you think it's just the robes and stuff? I mean, where are you gonna make the separations? I mean, you say that all the stuff these white people did is crazy." So I know you don't believe what these white people say about the relationship of the clitoris to female orgasm. Say, I know you don't believe none of that, because Africans know you don't even need it, you know. And of course, that didn't make me very popular amongst that wing, you know what I'm saying? And then you have people who embrace certain ideas just because they made white people mad, you know what I mean? I mean, like the average black person would have never even gone for the lunatic, the nature of Elijah Muhammad's organization. Now they might spout his ideas to make some white people mad. Y'all are all devils or something like that, but they weren't gonna stop eating pork. You know what I'm saying? They weren't gonna go in an organization gonna tell you what sexual positions you could get in with your wife or not. They weren't gonna. They just weren't going to do that. They just wanted to take. It was like somebody that's walking down the street with a wheelbarrow full of mud, right? And you can scoop out the mud that you want and throw it at somebody else. You know, now that doesn't mean you want to push the wheelbarrow. You know what I mean? Or let us say better, that the wheelbarrow is on the backs of a group of people who are crawling down the street. Now you may say, "Yeah, brother, that's right. Take some mud and throw it at somebody." But you don't want to get up under that wheelbarrow and crawl down the street carrying it. You know what I'm saying? So you have to. So a lot of it was just really kind of adolescent and insipid, and it was also based on the proximity that a lot of youthful would-be black intellectuals had to disenchanted white people. So that whereas white kids had come to the conclusion that there was a generation gap, right? Then a lot of these black kids unknowingly had, through osmosis, picked up this idea and decided. You know, at the suggestion of Malcolm X, that everybody black before him was some kind of an Uncle Tom. You know what I'm saying? And if those people had been Uncle Toms, he wouldn't have been a television celebrity in 1960. You know what I'm saying? So it's that kind of thing. I mean, it's much more complicated than I'm running down right now, but I mean, it's nothing but radio anyway.
You're talking about some of this in the past, but there's still a strong Muslim movement in America and a strong movement of people who relate in terms of other dress or ceremony or ritual to African customs. Do you still find that to be a kind of trendy or superficial thing?
Oh, no. If you probably most of the people who are doing it now are pretty serious. But, you know, but I mean, that's the greatness of the United States. Is it's the, see, to me, what I recently called the continual pluralistic redefinition of human value is the thing I think is the major achievement of the 20th century. That today you cannot go kill two Eskimos, whomsoever you are. You say they're just Eskimos. Somebody say, no, those are two human beings. You can't do that. Now, that doesn't mean you won't necessarily get away with it if you're a country that has enough power to do it. But you won't be able to dismiss those people on the basis of the fact that they're different from you. You know, and I think that is the thing. I mean, that's far more important than technology, because you have there've been technological advances since the beginning of humankind. You know, but the fact that you can't kill somebody in Vietnam, you can't kill a South African, you can't, somebody can't, guys can no longer say, well, she just wanted it. She was trying to get it. You know, I said, wait a minute. You know, see, it's just like Anatomy of a Murder, for instance, is the most important sexual statement that's come out of Hollywood in the last 25 years, because the Lee Remick character is a flirt. She is a tramp. She is all of that, you know. But when the guy rapes her and her husband kills her, the movie says, takes the position that regardless of how she carries herself, you do not have the right, you know, to invade her body. Now, she, you know, and see, that's the beauty of the movie, is they don't make her, oh, she's not like that. She is like that. You know what I'm saying? But the movie says, regardless, you can't, some guy, just because you've had a few beers, you can't just say, well, she was acting like this, and she wears those kind of clothes, and she was, and so I just took it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, like, there's been no movie to me that's come out of Hollywood that's made a statement that strong about where the line is in terms of you're invading individual, the rights of the individual. You know what I'm saying? You know what I mean?
But how does that tie in, though, with if you see Muslim and back to African?
I'm just saying that all these things, I'm just saying that the plural, to see that that's another example of pluralism to me.
Okay.
Is that there was a period in which if a woman carried herself a certain way, if a guy took sexual advantage of her, if she was drunk or something, against her will, right, he could say, well, she led me on, she wanted it. And so, and then people would kind of sympathize with him. You know what I mean? And all I'm saying is that if the people want to be Africans, as long as they pay income tax, you know, and don't embrace some kind of barbaric practices that involve mutilation of female daughters, like these Malinese workers are doing presently in France. They're arguing for the right to sexually mutilate their daughters. It's fine to me. I mean, I don't care what anybody does. You know, I mean, as long as it doesn't embrace some kind of bestial, barbaric practice, you know, they can do it. But I mean, but that's what I'm saying. See, oftentimes the things that these people claim they are embracing, the societies that they genuflect before would never allow somebody as different as they are in this country to exist in that.
Well, I think there's a tendency in this country to sentimentalize your past, whatever your past is, or whatever your, wherever your ancestors were, or wherever they were from. When you think of, like, your background or your roots, I don't know if that's something you think about much or not, but do you think about it, and if so, what do you think of it as being? Like, to what part of the world or to what part of society do you really feel, like, most connected, or do you not think in those terms?
Well, I consider myself an all-American guy. You know what I mean? I mean, like, my great-great-grandfather on my father's side is Irish. My great-great-grandfather on my mother's side was from what was then called Madagascar, now called Malagasy. He was part Asian and African, tall guy with slanted eyes and dark skin, straight black hair. He married a Choctaw Indian in 1863 and moved into Arkansas and later into Texas. And so, you know, so what can I say? I mean, you know, they got American Indian in the family, they got an Irish American in the family, African in the family, and Asian in the family. So I guess I just have to call myself an all-American guy. You know, the upshot of which is that I feel I like John Ford movies with John Wayne in them as much as I like Duke Ellington's music with Johnny Hodges in it. You know, and I like I like Fred Astaire. I like, I mean, I just like American stuff. I mean, but not to the, I mean, I like Joyce and, I mean, anything that, you know, expresses what I guess I consider is what's going on. You know, it can be Kurosawa. It doesn't matter where it comes from, you know. But basically, though, my favorite tastes are for American things, you know what I mean? Not necessarily the most vulgar, commercial, and empty aspects of the United States, you know. But American stuff I like most. Especially when I went to Europe, that convinced me even more.
Why?
Well, Europeans, they're all right. They're coming along, but I think they're not really a part of it. They're not part of the 20th century, and as much as we are, as people, you know, because they haven't had to deal with the kind of variety that we've had to deal with since maybe the Renaissance.
I know this is something that you've discussed a lot and probably don't want to discuss again, but you've talked about some musicians as being very European influenced in their music and have criticized them for that. What's wrong with that if you perceive their music as having classical or European harmonies in it?
Well, it's not so much. I mean, well, see, the thing about jazz now is harmony. You know what I mean? I mean, the thing that separates jazz from other African-derived musics in the Western Hemisphere is the sophisticated combination of elements that you get in other African-derived musics in this hemisphere, you know, like call and response, syncopation, what they call a vocalized approach to instruments, you know, the attempt to make an instrument have a vocal inflection, improvisation. Those things you can find in some Caribbean music, you can find it in Cuba, you can find it in so-and-so. See, but when you hear Louis Armstrong say, beep boop ba ba doo dee, do dee ba boop dee da, you just ain't gonna hear that over there because they don't know enough stuff. You know, and it's not like they can't do it, but it's just through a historical accident, Black American musicians came in contact with a certain kind of harmonic material, a lot of my harmonic material that people like Morton and Armstrong and Ellington and Monk and others transmogrified to such an extent that they came up with something distinctly different from the way that those things are used in European music. Now, my contention is that many of the people who do make very heavy-handed uses of European music, European techniques, don't do it as well as the guys that they're copying. That's what I'm saying. I mean, like, you don't want to hear some guy from the Black Forest try to play like B.B. King, you know what I'm saying, and go tell you that, I like B.B. King. I like him. And so you're supposed to go, oh, then your music is good as his. You know what I'm saying? That's all I mean. If they did it as well, further, there's a long tradition of Black classical musicians who have been first rate. You know what I mean? You know, I mean, Roland Hayes, Marian Anderson, this woman from New Orleans in the early part of the 19th century, who's known as the Black Swan. She was supposed to be able to sing 29 pure tones. I mean, so for these clowns to come forward acting as though these people haven't done this, I mean, Leontine Price, my God, you know what I'm saying? Jesse Norman, I mean, they're acting as though these people didn't achieve this, you know? And so, I mean, I'm not interested in if you're going to do it, do it on a blue ribbon level. You know what I mean? Don't come in with a saxophone and some war paint and some rhetoric. Tell me I'm supposed to swallow this just because you say it's new, you know?
How do you feel about the word jazz?
Oh, it's fine. Some
people won't use it now because its derivation has to do with, I don't remember precisely, but with its derivation has to do with what, drinking or I don't know. You'd probably know.
But some people say it's supposed to have been a code word for sexual engagement. But, you see, there again, though, is yet another example of the pompous Victorian fakery of these cats. Because the same guys that'll get up in an interview and say, I want you to call my music jazz because jazz means to screw. That same guy, you'll see him on a break and he'll be going, boy, that was a fine one out there in the front row, wasn't it, Crouch? I think she was looking at me. Now, see, he gonna do that, then somebody come in there with a microphone and talk about, yes, and my music is not about da-da-da-da-da-da, fraud. Further, why embrace, why negate the, I mean, what is, you know, I mean, why take on a Victorian posture when one of the most important things about jazz is that it has, it has had a long tradition of rendering sexual experience in a very broad range, from the most hilarious, you know, erotic songs all the way to the most deeply felt, you know. And further in, it's only due to racism that somebody like Mae West was able to crib so many things from blues songs and project them into her lines, you know, like, if you don't like my apples, don't shake my tree. I mean, she didn't make that up. She heard Bessie Smith and these other people saying it, but they didn't have entree to the movies. So she walks around with that third-rate drag queen get-up that she had on. And you got all these people going, Mae West, she was one of the seers. Now, see, everything they think she was doing is better done in the blues. You know what I'm saying? And so it's fake. And that's the thing that bothers me, is it's fraud. You know, I've only known one jazz musician who's taken that position who actually does have a hermetic attitude towards eroticism. Only one. Everybody else was the exact opposite.
You've also, in your columns, used the word Negro a lot, which right. is a word that's been abandoned and substituted with black for most people. Why do you choose to use that word?
Well, for one thing, I mean, I may go back to colored soon because I think it's more accurate, you know. Firstly, the word black is inaccurate. I mean, look at this guy in here in the studio. This guy's got wavy hair. He's the color of it's a little bit lighter than a vanilla wafer. Now, how am I going to call him black? That's inaccurate. You know what I'm saying? I'm not black. I mean, I'm much darker than he is, but I'm not black. You know what I mean? I have seen what a person who's black looks like, and there are not a whole lot of them around. You know what I'm saying? They're not, I mean, when somebody is black, I mean, it's another thing. And it's not ugly. I'm just saying that black is such an inaccurate term. I mean, that's why I actually prefer the term Caucasian to white, too. You ain't white. I mean, this handkerchief is white. You don't look like this handkerchief. So, I mean, both of the terms are basically inaccurate. I've interchanged Negro, black, African-American, you know, interchangeable. But I think I may go back to colored soon. They really won't like that one, probably.
Well, with language, it's not only what it literally means, but the connotations that the word's gotten through the way it's used. And since black is a word that people chose to call themselves in an attempt to accentuate a positive connotation with the word, and colored was a word that was perceived to be derogatory and a word that was given to people, the colored and Negro also had negative connotations in black, positive ones. So how does that measure?
First, we have to look at the source of this matter. This comes from rhetorical verbiage popularized by Malcolm X at the behest of a functional illiterate named Elijah Muhammad. Now, the first thing is, they are the ones that said that. You know, I mean, I was there. White man call you a Negro. You don't even know who you are. He brought you over here, blah, 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 blah. A Negro, how you gonna grow on your knees? I mean, this is the level that this conversation was on now, 22, 23 years ago, see? So now suddenly you got white people, they wanna be sympathetic and they're not gonna use the word Negro, right? Now, I'm just saying this. Firstly, if you're gonna talk about slavery, right? the last person or the last group that's going to be able to attack white people is anybody that's genuflecting before some damn Arabs. Now, the slave trade was triangular because it was organized by the Arabs. The slaves, the Africans went into the bush and got the other Africans and sold them to the Europeans. Now, because these clowns in Hollywood decided that they're going to go along and promote some garbage through roots, they have these Africans sitting up here as Muslims who are then kidnapped. And people talking about, don't go by tall grass. Beware the white man. I saw the white man today. Now, if you study the slave trade, white guys didn't go into the bush. They waited on the beach. The Africans went and got them. You know what I'm saying? And so if they were Muslim when they got there, that meant that they'd already been colonized during the Islamic sweep. You know? But now, see, these people don't want to deal with that. That's too complicated. They want a villain. So they say, give me the white man. It he fault. You know what I'm saying? You know, some Arab comes and talking to me about, well, my brother. I says, fine. But, you know, if they're going to be some reparations for slavery, y'all going to have to up some too. You know, and you can't let the Africans off the hook. You know, I mean, they did. We are here because they sold us over here. You know, however, history being what it is, had there not been slavery, we'd have no Sugar Ray Robinson. We'd have no Sugar Ray Leonard. We would have no Duke Ellington. We'd have no Louis Armstrong. We wouldn't have a Joe Louis. Martin Luther King wouldn't have happened. So that's the way history is. It was horrible. It was inhuman. Many people suffered, but history, people change. You know, trauma is central to social and historical change. And as it turns out, though I would have preferred for it to be much more easeful, I wouldn't give up those individuals that I mentioned, nor the neighborhood that I grew up in, nor the cuisine developed that I've eaten in my family's home in Texas, nor the game songs, the dances, et cetera, that I've observed from one end of America to the other that have been invented and perpetuated and constant variations played upon by black people, to be back in Africa. You know, now that may sound to some people sick, but I know this. The history of the United States is, it telescopes, and what America did between, when Cortez confronted Moctezuma in 1520, what happened between 1520 and 1865 when the first modern war was fought over the question of slavery, regardless of what Marxists want to say, and that what a lot of what it had, what took centuries to happen in Europe, happened in the United States in about 450 years. You know, we've seen it happen even faster with the Japanese from when Perry went into the Orient to now, you know, with them with the computers and so on. So what I'm just saying is that America is first major power that telescoped an enormous amount of historical change that is from clans conquering, the creation of a national identity, et cetera. Those same kind of things it took France, Germany, and other places many centuries to bring off. We brought off more quickly. Now, in that process, you know what I mean? In Europe, it cost Europeans a lot of pain to make those changes. You know, in the change that created African Americans, that painful change was what a musician in Detroit calls the crucible of slavery. You know, now it cannot be sentimentalized, but it was a necessity. As in the sense that that's what did happen, you know. Now, I would have preferred for Africans to come here as immigrant tourists too, you know, but that's not the way it went, you know. But I think we won out against history, you know, and not everybody does.
Let me reintroduce you for listeners just joining us and speaking with Village Voice columnist Stanley Crouch. We've got just a few minutes remaining. I'd like to hear what you think is the most interesting things happening in jazz now.
It's very difficult. See, I think jazz is in the middle of a golden age. I think that there are many, many, many fine players of many different styles. And in other words, I think you can hear somebody like Jay McShann, You can hear Barry Harris. You can hear Tommy Flanagan. You can hear Sammy Price. You can hear Don Pullen. I mean, it's the range is enormous, you know, on almost every instrument. And so that's the thing that I'm thrilled about, that you can go hear Wynton Marsalis. He's 21. You can go hear, he plays trumpet. You can go hear Doc Cheatham, who plays trumpet, and he's 75, and he's a son of a bitch on the trumpet now. So what I mean is you've got that range on that instrument with, I mean, Dizzy Gillespie, Freddie Hubbard, all those people falling in between. And that's the thing to me that's exciting, is that you can, in New York anyway, in New York, you can hear masters and emergent masters in almost across the stylistic planes.
At the beginning of the interview, you told us that when you started listening to jazz, it was, in a way to separate yourself from other people. Do you think jazz is a popular music now? Where do you see it fitting into popular music now?
Well, I think jazz is still primarily a music of separation in that sense. I think it's a music of aspiration. I think it's a music for adults. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's not a childish music. You know, see, I think that overexposure to adolescent forms is not good for adults. You know, I mean, the people who go to Studio 54 and places like that, they're screwed up. You know what I'm saying? Because they're 40 years old, they're 50 years old, and they're listening to this nattering, adolescent, self-obsessive jargon. You know? And I mean, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, why should an adult want to listen to Elvis Costello? That just is dumb to me. I mean, this is just a little punk. You know what I'm saying? And it has nothing to do with his age. It has nothing to do with his age.
What do you put on when you put on the radio?
I don't listen to the radio. I mean, sometimes I listen to classical stations because my radio is bad, so I can't pick up the better jazz stations. And also, I like to listen to some classical music. I mean, you know, they have something to say. You know, they're doing the best they can anyway. You know, but I just think that, like I said, I think the major significance of jazz is it has exuberance, and it's celebratory, it's unsentimental, and it's adult. And if you were like me, if you grew up listening to people playing it and playing whist and slapping those dominoes down on the table saying 25, you know, you always said, I want to get up there with them. That was it.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. I regret we didn't get to play any more music, but thanks so much for being here. I really enjoyed the hours.